What if the exact traits that make you this like visionary, high achieving leader are actually the exact same traits that are causing your team to secretly burn out?
Yeah, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Right. Because, you know, we all have this picture in our heads, the person standing at the front of the room just radiating absolute certainty.
So the classic heroic leader.
Exactly. They have the grand vision, they give the rousing speech, and everyone just, you know, charges forward into battle. Or, well, Q4 sales.
Right. Whichever comes first.
Yeah. We have this really deep-seated cultural reverence for the leader who can just kind of bend the world to their will. But what if that model is, well, what if it's fundamentally flawed?
I mean, it's a question that completely upends how we traditionally view success in the workplace.
Yeah.
We are so conditioned to reward that top-down momentum that we rarely, if ever, stop to examine the collateral damage that kind of leadership leaves in its wake.
Which is exactly why the materials we are diving into today are just so compelling. So for you listening, we're doing a deep dive into this highly personal, really fascinating collection of reflective documents.
Mm-hmm.
They were written by an educational professional who is clearly on a leadership pathway. They mention working towards something like the NPQH.
Right, the National Professional Qualification for Headship over in the UK.
Exactly. It's essentially this rigorous training ground for future school principals. And what this professional is doing in these documents is taking that classic high-octane transformational leadership model.
The visionary stuff.
Yeah, the visionary stuff. And filtering it entirely through the lens of Robert Greenleaf's 10 principles of servant leadership. Okay, let's unpack this. If transformational leadership is the engine pushing an organization forward, you know, generating the horsepower and the sheer speed to hit your targets,
right.
Servant leadership is the steering wheel and the suspension. It is what ensures the ride is actually smooth, that the passengers are safe, and that the car actually stays on the road instead of like vibrating itself to pieces.
That is a great way to look at it. And what's fascinating here is the deliberate collision of those two philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
Because transformational leadership is traditionally all about motivation, mm-hmm. right? It's about pushing people to achieve their absolute maximum potential to reach a specific destination.
Push, push, push.
Exactly. But when you inject Greenleaf's principles of servant leadership into that model, you add this crucial human-centered dimension.
Yeah. Yeah.
It shifts the leader's primary focus from simply hitting the organizational targets to actively nurturing the human beings who are actually responsible for hitting those targets.
Oh, yeah.
It completely flips the script. Instead of asking, you know, how can I use my people to achieve my vision? It asks, how can my vision serve the growth of my people?
Right. And what becomes immediately clear in these documents is that before a leader can even begin to change an organization or, you know, inspire a team, they have to look inward.
Oh, absolutely. The inner game.
Yes. You absolutely cannot manage the room if you cannot manage yourself. The sources focus heavily on this internal state first. Like, the author shares this incredibly vulnerable moment where they suddenly realize they were completely dominating a meeting.
Yeah. That was a striking moment.
It really was. They recognized their own tendency to just take over the airwaves, and they consciously forced themselves to step back, bite their tongue, and actually let others speak.
Which is incredibly difficult to do.
Oh, tell me about it.
Because when you are in a position of authority, silence feels like this vacuum that you are uniquely obligated to fill.
Yes.
But true self-awareness isn't just, you know, taking a personality quiz and knowing your strengths. It is the real-time recognition of your own physiological and emotional triggers.
Right. And the author actually contrasts that successful meeting with another moment where they reacted defensively to feedback.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even pause to consider if the feedback was valid. Their immediate reflex was just to put up a wall.
And that is so common.
It's funny you say that because my instinct as a manager, or honestly even just in a group project, is to always have the answer. Stepping back feels like, I don't know, like I'm not doing my job. It feels like I'm dropping the ball.
Right. And that instinct is exactly what the author is trying to decode in these reflections. Mm-hmm. When we receive negative feedback, the amygdala.
The gut center, right.
Exactly. The part of the brain responsible for processing threats. It often hijacks our logical thinking. We literally go into a fight or flight response over a spreadsheet or a lesson plan.
Over a spreadsheet? That is wild.
It is. And the author notes that after a particularly difficult day, They had to sit down and actively identify the specific triggers that were eroding their patience.
Wow.
Because when a leader lacks that real-time self-awareness, their unresolved stress just leaks out and becomes the team's problem.
Yeah, it becomes contagious. But when they possess it, they can intercept their own bad habits before they contaminate the room.
Which is why they set a specific goal to keep a reflective journal, specifically to track those emotional triggers. It is almost like reviewing the game tape of your own mind.
That's a great analogy, yeah.
But just understanding your own triggers isn't really enough if you're constantly getting blindsided by external events, right?
Yes.
Like, you have to be able to look ahead.
Yes.
The author talks a lot about strategic anticipation or foresight.
Foresight, yes.
Yes.
It's essentially the ability to connect the lessons of the past with the realities of the present, to anticipate the likely future. It is a fundamental survival skill for any organization.
And we see a brilliant example of this in the text. The author noticed these very early, super subtle warning signs of stress in a trainee teacher. Mm-hmm. And because they were paying attention, they used that intuition to proactively adjust the trainee's workload before it turned into full-blown burnout. They intervened upstream.
Which is huge.
It is. But then they also share this massive failure of foresight. They completely failed to anticipate a technology issue that ended up derailing this really important high-stakes lesson.
Right, the tech failure.
Yeah. And this isn't just about classrooms, you know? If you're a project manager rolling out new software to a corporate team and you haven't anticipated the IT bottlenecks or the user pushback, you're doing the exact same thing. You're failing at foresight.
Exactly. The mechanism of foresight requires balancing your human intuition with hard logistical scenario planning.
Okay, balancing those two.
Yeah. You use your intuition to read the human elements, like noticing that a team member is uncharacteristically quiet, which signals stress.
Right.
But you need rigorous, proactive planning to handle the systems of the tech. When a leader neglects foresight, the result is an environment defined by completely avoidable setbacks.
Yeah, just constantly putting out fires.
Exactly. You spend all your energy fighting fires that you yourself allowed to ignite, which just absolutely destroys team morale.
Man, that is so true. Now, as we move through these internal principles, there is a term used in the sources that I have to admit I really want to push back on a little bit.
Okay, let's hear it.
Greenleaf calls it healing and humility. Now, humility, I get. Nobody likes an arrogant boss.
True.
But healing, isn't healing a bit of a soft word for the workplace? Huh. I mean, if you are running a busy school department or a high-pressure corporate sales team, do we really have time for healing? It sounds a bit like we should all sit in a circle, hold hands, and share our feelings while the competitors eat our lunch.
I completely understand why you'd say that.
Yeah.
It is a word that almost universally catches people off guard in a corporate or institutional context.
Yeah, it just feels a bit out of place.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, healing in this framework isn't about running a workplace therapy clinic.
Okay.
It is about the mechanical efficiency of your team.
Efficiency? Wait, how so?
Healing means intentionally creating an environment of psychological safety where mistakes are treated as data points for learning, not terminal failures. Let's look at the specific example the author provides.
Okay.
They talk about mediating a conflict between staff members. Now, the traditional heroic leader comes in as the infallible judge, bangs the gavel, and tells everyone to just get back to work.
Right. Just solve it and move on.
Exactly. But this leader actually started the mediation by admitting to their own scheduling mistake that had contributed to the staff's problem in the first place.
Oh, wow. They own their piece of the mess right out of the gate.
They did. And the text contrasts this with a previous bad experience where the leader avoided apologizing for a minor scheduling error.
And what happened?
Well, that lack of an apology caused lingering toxic tension with colleagues. It created these informal back channels of complaining.
Oh, the dreaded Slack channels of doom.
Exactly. By embracing vulnerability and admitting a seemingly minor mistake, the leader facilitated a positive resolution. They healed the rift. You have to understand that in a high-stakes environment, unresolved tension is friction.
Friction, yeah.
It slows down every email, every meeting, every project. Healing isn't holding hands. Healing is the active process of removing that friction so the team can actually function at top speed.
Man, that completely flips my perspective on it. You are healing the workflow by healing the trust.
Exactly.
Okay, so once a leader has actually mastered this internal foundation, they are intercepting their own triggers, they are anticipating roadblocks, they are humble enough to remove friction by admitting fault, how does that translate into day-to-day interactions?
Right, moving outward.
Yeah, we have to move from the self to the other. Let's look at the one-on-one dynamic because the sources place a massive emphasis on active listening.
And rightfully so, because active listening is the absolute bridge between your internal strategy and the external reality of your team. You cannot possibly understand the friction your team is facing if you aren't actually absorbing what they are telling you.
Right. And the author shares a great success story here. In a planning meeting, instead of just letting the loudest, most confident voices dominate the agenda, they intentionally paused.
Mm-hmm.
They created space and actively encouraged the quieter team members to speak. And the result was this set of completely new, inclusive ideas that wouldn't have surfaced otherwise.
That's a great win.
It is. But they contrast this with a really painful failure. They admit to interrupting a trainee teacher mid-explanation.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because the leader jumped in too early, assuming they already knew what the trainee was going to say. They missed the vital information about what the trainee was actually struggling with in the classroom.
And that happens all the time.
So what does this all mean? To me, it means active listening isn't just politely waiting in line for your turn to speak so you can drop your own knowledge. It is playing detective. It is an active, focused investigation to uncover what the person actually needs rather than what your ego assumes they need.
That detective analogy is spot on. Think about the psychology of interrupting. When you interrupt someone, you are essentially signaling to them, my assumption of what you are going to say is more valuable than your actual reality.
Ouch. Yeah.
It is a microaggression of power that completely dismantles trust. And active listening only gets you the raw data. Once you play detective and hear that an employee is struggling, what you actually do with that information dictates whether you build the relationship or destroy it.
Right, the follow through.
Exactly. Which brings in the ethical weight of the next principle, empathy.
And the stakes for empathy are incredibly high in these reflections. The author details the positive impact of simply acknowledging a trainee's frustration with classroom management.
Just acknowledging it.
Yeah. Just validating that, yes, this is incredibly hard and your frustration makes sense. Built immense trust. But the bad experience they share is brutal to read.
If you have the observation feedback.
Right. They admit to a time when they dismissed a trainee's genuine feelings about a failed lesson observation by just telling them it was just nerves.
Which is a textbook example of toxic positivity.
Right. And on the surface, a manager might think they're being helpful. Hey, don't worry. It's just nerves. You'll get them next time. Why is that so damaging?
Because it completely invalidates the person's lived experience.
Yeah.
When you dismiss a genuine professional failure or struggle as just nerves, you are refusing to sit with them in their discomfort.
Wow.
Neurologically, this triggers a threat response. The employee feels unseen, misunderstood, and fundamentally unsafe sharing their reality with you.
So they just shut down.
Literally. The brain's learning centers shut down. They can no longer absorb feedback or grow. They retreat into a defensive survival mode. If you dismiss a colleague's feelings, you're telling them their experience doesn't matter to you. And if their experience doesn't matter to you, your grand transformational vision is certainly not going to matter to them.
They just check out. Which brings the entire operation to a grinding halt. Because the leader's ultimate job, according to this framework, is a commitment to the growth of people.
Yes.
It is not just about extracting value to get the immediate task done. It is about leaving the person more capable than they were yesterday.
A hallmark of standard transformational leadership is empowering others to hit the goal. But servant leadership makes the growth of the individual an explicit, non-negotiable commitment, regardless of the immediate output.
We see this clearly when the author decides to run specific workshops to develop their colleagues' digital literacy and when they actively take the time to coach trainees.
Mm-hmm.
That is a direct investment in the human capital of the building.
Right.
But they also share a scenario where they assumed a student could just self-manage a complex task without any guidance.
Right, just handed it off.
Yeah, they just handed it off, assumed it would be fine, and completely set that student up for failure.
And if we synthesize all these one-on-one interactions, the listening, the empathy, the commitment to growth, what we are really looking at is a fundamental shift in how leaders utilize power.
Okay.
It's a shift from positional power to relational power.
Break that down for us.
Positional power relies entirely on your title. It says, I am the boss, so I'm going to talk, you are going to listen, and your feelings are irrelevant to the task.
The classic top-down approach.
Right. Relational power, on the other hand, says, I am going to understand your specific context validate your struggles, and give you the tools you need to grow.
Wow.
Positional power demands compliance. Relational power invites commitment. You can run someone's compliance with a paycheck, but you have to earn their commitment through empathy and investment.
That is a huge distinction.
It is.
Yeah.
And failing to provide that investment doesn't just hurt that one employee. It mathematically limits the capacity and the output of the entire organization.
Because an organization is ultimately just a web of those one-on-one relationships. Okay, so we've looked at managing the internal self, and we've looked at managing the individual across the desk. Finally, we need to scale this up.
The big picture.
Right. How does a servant leader move a whole community forward, driving a large-scale vision across dozens or even hundreds of people without just relying on raw authority? Let's talk about persuasion.
This is where the theory truly gets tested in the real world.
Yeah, the author shares a really compelling story here. They wanted to introduce a brand new digital teaching tool to the staff. Now, as the leader, they could have just sent a mass email saying, effective Monday, everyone must use this platform, no exceptions.
Which happens everywhere.
Everywhere. But instead, they took the time to convince the team to trial it by actively demonstrating the benefits. They won them over. And they specifically contrast this with a past failure where they tried to push a new policy without listening to the team's concerns, which resulted in massive immediate resistance. Here's where it gets really interesting. There is a massive distinction here between persuasion and coercion. But again, I have to play devil's advocate for a second.
Stop for it.
When quarterly deadlines are incredibly tight, when the pressure is just raining down from the higher ups, can a leader really afford the luxury of time it takes to persuade everyone? Isn't it just infinitely more efficient to use your title to say, do this right now?
This raises an important question, and it is the classic eternal dilemma of management.
Mm.
Yes, using your authority to mandate a change is much faster in the next 5 minutes.
Right.
But the text and decades of organizational psychology take a very clear stance on this. Relying on positional power almost always meets hidden resistance.
Mm-hmm.
If you force a change without genuine buy-in, you aren't actually saving time. You are just borrowing time from the future.
Borrowing time from the future. I love that.
Because you will spend 10 times as long managing the inevitable fallout.
Oh, man. So true.
You will spend months policing the new policy, dealing with deliberate inefficiencies, and managing staff who are actively looking for ways to undermine the system simply because they felt disrespected by the rollout.
Wow, yeah.
Guiding colleagues with reasoned argumentation, hard evidence, and compelling storytelling produces lasting engagement. When people choose to follow a direction because they actually believe in it, they will push through roadblocks on their own.
Right.
If they're just following orders, the moment they hit a snag, they will drop the ball, cross their arms, and wait for you to fix it.
Not my problem.
Exactly.
Which means your efficiency drops to zero. You aren't just selling a new software tool. You are trying to buy their discretionary effort, that extra 20% of problem solving they only give when they actually care.
Spot on.
And speaking of getting creative to gain that buy-in, the author also focuses heavily on conceptualization and creative thinking. They highlight a highly specific, successful example of designing a cross-curricular project that integrated art and digital skills. It wasn't just a standard, rigid lesson. It was an innovative way to bridge two completely different departments to engage students.
And that requires a leader who is willing to tolerate the messy, unpredictable process of innovation.
Yeah, innovation is rarely neat.
Think about this in a corporate context. If you can get your marketing department and your software engineering department out of their silos to conceptualize a project together, the results are explosive.
Oh, totally.
But the text explicitly contrasts this creative success with the stifling nature of implementing rigid, top-down plans that reject colleagues' innovative ideas. If you want a transformational organization, you cannot micromanage the how. You have to set the vision and allow people to experiment.
Which naturally leads to the final two principles we see in these documents, stewardship and building community. The author talks extensively about their duty of care. This means ensuring resources are fairly distributed, mentoring new colleagues who are struggling, and actively monitoring the mental well-being of both students and the staff.
Mm-hmm.
They consciously prioritized the long-term welfare of the team over purely focusing on short-term task completion.
Because stewardship is the profound ethical responsibility to leave the organization and the people in it better than you found them.
Wow.
It is the fundamental recognition that your people are not just gears in a machine designed to achieve your quarterly vision. They're the most valuable resource you have been entrusted to protect.
And when people genuinely feel protected, you can truly build a community. The author mentions organizing cross-department projects specifically to break down tribal silos.
Yeah.
They realized that ignoring team dynamics in the past had allowed conflicts to escalate, so they intentionally fostered a shared purpose. They brought people out of their little departmental bubbles to see the bigger picture of what they were all building together.
That is the ultimate payoff of synthesizing these two leadership styles.
How so?
Well, transformational leadership provides the community with a shared, ambitious, exciting destination. But Greenlee's focus on community building, inclusion, and mutual support, that is the suspension system that ensures the group actually survives the journey together.
I love that analogy.
It creates a resilient culture where all voices are valued. Yeah. And when conflicts inevitably arise, because they always do, they are addressed constructively and openly, rather than allowed to fester in the dark and destroy the team from the inside out.
It is an incredibly powerful synthesis. So just to briefly recap the core narrative we've been tracking through these reflections, if you take the visionary, forward-driving energy of transformational leadership and you anchor it deep within the ethical, deeply empathetic roots of servant leadership, you create something uniquely sustainable.
Yes.
It is a human-centered approach to guiding others. It is no longer just about hitting the metrics. It is about systematically building the capacity, the resilience, and the trust of the people hitting those metrics.
And that is exactly why this framework matters directly to you, the listener, regardless of your industry or your job title.
Right. You don't need a fancy title for this.
Exactly. You don't need to be training for a headship or sitting in a CEO's chair to apply this. Whether you manage a massive corporate department, lead a scrappy three-person startup, teach a classroom, or even if you just want to be a more effective, respected presence in your local community board.
Yeah.
The human mechanics remain exactly the same.
Absolutely. The universal principles are right there for the taking.
Uh-huh.
Implementing structured check-ins to play detective and make sure the quiet voices are actually heard. Mm-hmm. Pausing to recognize your own emotional triggers before you send that defensive email. Recognizing that toxic positivity shuts down learning.
Right.
Or simply having the humility to say, you know what? I messed up the schedule, I created this bottleneck, and I apologize. These tiny, deliberate actions remove the friction in your organization. They can radically change how human beings respond to your leadership.
They systematically shift your influence away from a fragile reliance on your title and toward a robust, unshakable reliance on trust and mutual respect.
Which brings us to a final lingering thought for you to take away from this deep dive.
Let's hear it.
Throughout these documents, the author didn't just passively reflect on the past. They set very specific, actionable goals for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their primary goals for developing that crucial self-awareness was to keep a reflective journal. They wanted to track their emotional responses, their quick judgments, and their leadership decisions in real time.
Which is hard work.
It is. Yeah. So we want to challenge you. If you were to track your own interactions, your own snap decisions, and your own emotional triggers for just 1 week, what would your journal reveal?
Oh, that's a great question.
When the pressure is on, the deadlines are tight, and the way forward is murky, would your actions show a visionary transformational leader? Would they show a humble servant committed to the growth of others? Or would they reveal someone relying just a bit too heavily on raw authority simply to get the task done?
It's definitely worth finding out.
Try tracking it. The engine of your ambition might be loud and powerful, but it is always worth checking who is actually holding the steering wheel.